Let's see, the news. We've got news for you today, and the news is that there's apparently nothing happening from Sky News. The sky is still up there. That's the news from the sky. The other news is that the moon is almost full. It'll be full on Saturday. It's going to be a spectacular full moon, and we're hoping that there'll be no clouds and no rain, but a full moon on Saturday night. That's the sky news from a different kind of sky. But I think it's time, since they're not coming through, it's time for me to take over. And we have a different kind of thing. I have to press this little button here, which I can't find. What's it called? A cursor? There's no cursor. It's gone. There's no cursor. We're not having any show tonight. I'm cursed with no cursor. It's on the other computer.
Move to the right.
Move to the right. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, we're having a little technical hitch. It's a glitch. Glitch being a, it's a little pedantry, glitch being a Yiddish word meaning slipping, as in slipping on the ice. And we have a little glitch. Why are we doing this? Because we have, I can do it like this, just a second. CD1 and...
Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday. And not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Well, here we are, back together, sharing this evening under lamplight on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. And we're full of jollity after that little glitch, and you'll all know what glitch means now. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and you can reach me at rla@momentsunderlamplight.co.uk or lamplight@cambridge105.fm. Listen to all our archived shows at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. And a warm welcome this evening to our studio guest, Andrew Abbey, visiting all the way from Liverpool. And he smiles and waves. He's waving at you. Hello. I haven't got his mic up. I'm not sure which one's his mic. But come join us. You are invited to attend as we take our next step along the way with Dante as he tries to set off once again on his journey through hell. But before we move on to Dante, I'd like to spend a few minutes on another subject. I recently received a CD of James Weldon Johnson's God's Trombones, Seven Negro Sermons in Verse, a collection of poems from 1927. Johnson, one of the great leaders of the Harlem Renaissance, an explosion of African-American literature, music, art, and culture, tried to recreate the verbal artistry of the old Southern black preachers that had long been a tradition in the South, and he felt it was now dying out. Now, I used to have a cassette of this work, but I don't have it anymore, or I have it and can't find it, or I can't play it, certainly even if I could find it. But finally, after a long search, I found a CD of it on eBay. Thank you, eBay. We don't need any more emails from you telling me about great hits you have for me. But at last, I could share with you James Pringle's performance of the sermon on the creation. But before we get to that, I want to tell you a story about the clash, or rather I'd say the non-clash, between creation and evolution. The story takes place several years ago. in a small class I was teaching with students who knew each other well, and so they brought a relaxed, not to say holiday, atmosphere to the classroom. In the middle of some discussion, one student suddenly calls out, "Hey, professor, can I ask you a question?" You heard the story, Andrew. You remember the story. Mm-hmm. "Hey, professor, can I ask you a question?" "Sure, what is it?" "Are you an evolutionist or a creationist?" "Sorry?" "Yeah, like, are you an evolutionist or a creationist?" "Now look," I said, "you don't really want to go into all that now, do you? It's not a question of either or. There are two different ways of looking at the world. These are two different ways, both equally valid in separate ways." "Yeah, I know, but which one are you?" "Well, I could either drop the subject or impose my authority and point out the absurdity of this either-or choices. Or I could be Socratic and throw the whole thing back to the class, which is what I did. I don't know what inspired me to proceed as I did, but I surely must have been inspired. I couldn't have come up with what follows on my own." "Okay," I said. "Has anyone here ever created anything?" "Yeah," said that first student. "Hey, I can pull down my fly and create something." No, I said, "that's procreation," throwing him off guard by taking him seriously on a different level. No, said another student. I guess I created something. A few years ago, my dad and I built a shed for our tools." "Oh, really?" I said, "and what did you do?" "Well, we went out and we bought the wood and some more nails and screws and the glass and the stuff for the roof." "And did you plan anything first?" "Oh, sure. We looked at some magazines and talked to my Uncle Dave, because he'd built a shed the year before, and we had to work out a kind of budget to see how much we could spend." "Good. So then what?" "Well, we got the foundations right and put up the walls, and then, well, we broke one of the panes of glass, so we had to go out and get another one, and we painted the whole thing, and, well, there it was." "Uh-huh. And you created it?" Yeah, we both worked together and created it." "But you know," I said, "what you've described is the gradual evolution of the shed from idea through plans through construction to a final product. So was it both creation and evolution?" Now, what happened next was amazing. His eyes lit up with a beautiful glow of comprehension. He actually held two different perspectives in his mind at the same time. Supple, charitable, and bright, as Robert Louis Stevenson once put it. But 5 minutes later, the eyes dulled again. He lost the ability to hold both views together. Back to the old certainties of either or. I mean, I hope this was not an isolated moment of epiphany in his education, but a part of a larger pattern of gradual enlightenment. And who knows how his subsequent education over the years may have evolved to reveal a truer, brighter self within, the self his creator had made for him.
Old Lucianburg had a gal way down in Tennessee. She told Lucian all about evolution. She was sitting down on his knee. Then one fine day, she got gay, started stamping out. But old brother Lucian started a revolution. The neighbors all could hear him shout.
What did he say
then? He said, "Evolution, mama, evolution, mama, don't you make a monkey out of me." He said, "Evolution, mama, don't you think you got me up a tree?" Now I remember the time I had you nice and tame. You was eating right out of my hand. But some fine day I'm gonna take good aim and knock that peanut whistle off of your stand. Now, evolution, mama, listen while I get you told.
Evolution, mama, don't you make a monkey out of me. It gets a little too violent at the end. He's going to go and get a gun and do her in. But it's a snappy tune from the Even Dozen Jug Band, even if we couldn't get to the end of it. It's a short... The Even Dozen Jug Band was a short-lived, cheerful band from about 1963 and included such diverse musicians as Steve Katz, leader of the Blues Project and Blood, Sweat and Tears, Maria Muldaur, just too good to speak of, Joshua Rifkin, who arranged the Scott Joplin numbers and who gave us the Baroque Beatles book, and John Sebastian, leader of the Love and Spoonful. Their playfulness about evolution and Brother Lucian seems right for undermining the self-righteousness often heard about this topic. But here's a little more playfulness of a slightly different sort, and also, I'm sure, more moving. As promised, here's James Pringle performing James Weldon Johnson's sermon on the creation, recorded before a live audience, and I invite you to attend. This really is a wonderful thing. Here it comes.
And God stepped out on space. And he looked around and said, I'm lonely. I'll make me a world. And far as the eye of God could see, darkness covered everything. Blacker than 100 midnights down in a cypress swamp. Then God smiled. And the light broke. And the darkness rolled up on one side, and the light stood shining on the other. And God said, that's good. Then God reached out and took the light in his hands, and God rolled the light around in his hands until it made the sun, and it set that sun blazing in the heavens. And the light that was left from making the sun, God gathered it up in a shining ball and flung it against the darkness, spangling the night with the moon and the stars. Then down between the darkness and the light, he hurled the world, and God said, that's good. Then God himself stepped down, and the sun was on his right hand, and the moon was on his left. The stars were clustered about his head, and the earth was under his feet, and God walked. And where he trod, his footsteps hollowed the valleys out and bulged the mountains up. Then he stopped and looked and saw that the earth was hot and barren. So God stepped over to the edge of the world and he spat out the seven seas. He batted his eyes, and the lightning flashed. He clapped his hands, and the thunder rolled. And the waters above the earth came down. The cooling waters came down. Then the little green grass sprouted, and the little red flowers blossomed. The pine tree pointed his fingers to the sky, and the oak spread out his arms. The lakes cuddled down in the hollows of the ground, and the rivers ran down to the sea. And God smiled again, and the rainbow appeared and curled itself around his shoulder. Then God raised his arm, and he waved his hand over the sea and over the land, and he said, bring forth. Bring forth! And quicker than God could drop his hand, fishes and fowls, beasts and birds swam the rivers and the seas, roamed the forests and the woods, and split the air with their wings. And God said, that's good. All right, all right. Then God walked around, and God looked around on all that he had made. He looked at his sun, and he looked at his moon, and he looked at all his little stars. Yes. He looked on his world with all its living things, and God said, I'm lonely still. Then God sat down on the side of a hill where he could think. By a deep, wide river, he sat down with his head in his hands. God thought and thought till he thought, I'll make me a man. Up from the bed of the river, God scooped the clay. And by the bank of the river, he kneeled him down. And there the great God Almighty, who lit the sun and fixed it in the sky, who flung the stars to the most far corner of the night, who rounded the earth in the palm of his hand. This great God, like a mammy bending over his baby, kneeled down in the dust, toiling over a lump of clay till he shaped it in his own image. Then into it he blew the breath of life. And man became a living soul. Yes, amen. 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 Amen.
Amen. Amen. Wasn't that wonderful? Wonderful. Well, listen, my teaching career seems to be measured by a series of classroom anecdotes, and what I'm reminded of whenever I hear this sermon is the sullen objection of one of my students to this piece. He was a pastor in a black church, and after I played the recording of The Creation, he had this great look of righteous indignation on his face. What could possibly be wrong? He refused to answer, preferring to stew in that righteous anger, so delicious a way for us to glow in the feeling that we are right. Finally, he managed to tell us that this was sinful because it did not tell the story of creation exactly as the Bible had told it. Therefore, it must be wrong. So much for supple, charitable, and bright minds. Hey, man, the guy sitting next to him said, hey, man, lighten up. He really said that. But there was no enlightenment, and this pastor missed one of the best accounts of creation by a God who was lonely, because a God of love is always lonely until there is something to love. And so you see, and here I'm making a transition, so you see, I'm trying to keep you from being lonely by sharing with you this evening under lamplight, full of things for you to love, via the lovely Cambridge 105, and brought to you by the loving, if not lovely, Robert Louis Abrahamson. Or as Soupy Sales used to say, you do that and I'll love you and I'll give you a great big kiss. Mwah! Andrew liked that. I like it too. Now we'll let Mazursky make the next transition for us over to this week's episode of Dante's Inferno. Last time, you will remember, we found Dante lost in the Selva Oscura, a dark wood. He came to himself, finding himself lost, and tried to work his own way out of the darkness and confusion by climbing out of that place. But he was stopped at every attempt by ferocious beasts that drove him in fear back into the woods. But this time, there in the woods, he found, coming up to him, the shade of Virgil, the greatest of the Latin poets, the one who had, from the first, been Dante's great inspiration. Virgil tells him that he cannot escape the woods by climbing. He has to go down through even greater darkness, down through the pit of hell, before he can then rise up the mountain of purgatory, and then ascend through the heavens to find his ultimate freedom. Dante is ready to do anything to get away from those beasts that have scared him so much, so he consents to take up the journey. And the first canto ends Then Virgil set out, and I came on behind him. Canto 2 begins, as many of the cantos do, with a glimpse at the everyday world. The world that Dante leaves behind on his journey, but that he never loses contact with. The day was departing, and the darkened air released the creatures of the earth from their labor. Only 2.5 lines, but very evocative. That image of dusk, a time of peaceful rest from our daily activities. We today may think about this time of day as a time of rush hour traffic, or perhaps we don't even think of the growing darkness as a time to stop work. But in days before electric lighting, the whole world made a shift when it got dark outside. The world is coming to a rest now at the end of the day, but for Dante, the journey, which he describes here as a war he's about to enter, the journey is just beginning. It's a nighttime journey, as we'd expect from a journey into the underworld. And we see in this that it is also a journey that separates Dante from the labors and concerns of the everyday world, as he very quickly perceives when he realizes, Io sol uno, I alone. Everyone must make this kind of journey alone. Oh, yeah, there's a guide, and that's essential, but basically we're alone, since, of course, the journey is really a journey deep within ourselves, and who else can come with us? Let's stop for a minute to hear Josh White singing Lonesome Road. He advises us to look down that lonesome road before we travel on. And that, it seems, is what Dante briefly does at this moment.
Look down, that lonesome road before you travel on. Look up, and seek your maker for Gabriel blows his horn. Weary toting such a load, trudging down that lonesome road. You look down, look down, that lonesome road before you travel on. Such a load, trudging down that lonesome road. You look down, that lonesome road before you travel on.
That was Josh White, Lonesome Road. Andrew says, what a lovely voice. And indeed, that's right. Well, Dante, too, has looked down that lonesome road and been frightened by what he sees. Dante becomes frightened because he realizes that he is, as I said, sol uno, only one, all alone on the journey, and he begins to pull back. We have to remember here at the beginning that Dante is none of your great heroes, constantly intrepid and brave. He's rather like every man, and represents all of us with all of our weaknesses. And who among us, suddenly understanding that we're about to venture down into the depths unprepared, would not suddenly think twice? But here, notice the way Dante thinks twice about this journey. He compares himself to those two heroes who also traveled to the underworld, Aeneas and Paul. Dante, the poet, is not at all bothered by the fact that St. Paul is a historical personage, but Aeneas is a fictional, or at least legendary, character. Aeneas, or Aeneas, is the hero of the Ennead or Aeneid, Virgil's great epic poem about the journey of Aeneas, who escapes from Troy after it is taken by the Greeks at the end of the Trojan War, and after many wanderings, including a detailed journey through the underworld. Aeneas lands in Italy and establishes the settlement that will later become Rome, the sacred site of both the empire and of the papacy. He was eletto, chosen by the heavenly power to carry out this mission. Being divinely chosen, of course he would have been able to survive a journey through hell. And the other one, St. Paul, did he travel to the underworld? You won't find it in the Bible. You'll find an oblique reference to Paul's being taken up to paradise, and some commentators see this heavenly journey as what Dante is referring to, but there's also a medieval book, the Visio Sancti Pauli, or Vision of St. Paul, which describes an obviously fictional journey of Paul into hell. And I seem to recall that it's the first account of hell that brings the devils in with pitchforks, that standard image that has come down to us today. We'll see later the one place where it appears in Dante's Inferno. So both Aeneas and Paul went on these journeys, both sanctioned by heaven. Well, good for them, but as Dante says in one of my favorite lines, Io non Aenea, io non Paolo sono. I'm not Aeneas, I'm not Paul. In other words, he, Dante, does not have any divine sanction for going on this journey. How could he ever hope to survive without it? And so Dante now decides that he won't go on the journey after all. As one who unwills what he has willed, the poem says, changing his intent on second thought so that he quite gives over what he has begun, such a man was I on that dark slope. With too much thinking, I had undone the enterprise so quick in its inception. Now there's a name for what just happened. It's called the refusal of the calling. It's a common stage on the mythic journey. The call to set out on this journey is so important that you can't get just one chance at it. In fact, because the call is made in your best interest, out of a benevolent concern for you, the caller wants to give you every chance. In this instance, it's Virgil's gentle concern, well, sort of gentle, that gives Dante his second chance. If I have rightly understood your words, he says to Dante, very courteous and gentle, your spirit is assailed by cowardice. Oops, not so gentle. Dante, you're just a coward, shrinking back from the difficulty of the task. Well, yes, perhaps, but it can seem that Virgil hasn't quite picked up on Dante's reason for refusing. It's not so much that he's afraid as that he cannot see any possibility of success unless he has the divine eletto, the divine sanction that the other heroes have had. Virgil ignores this motive for a minute to give Dante that slap in the face of being called a coward. He has to recognize that fear within him before he can go further. But then watch the way Virgil knows exactly what Dante needs. You're not alone in showing cowardice, Virgil says. Cowardice weighs upon many people and turns them back from noble purposes. Well, that's some comfort, I suppose. But Virgil shows that he's well aware of Dante's real concern. To free you from this fear, he says, I'll tell you why I came and what I heard when first I felt compassion for you. And That why and what will explain to Dante why he is in the same position as Aeneas and Paul. Io sol uno, he was thinking. He thinks he's alone. All he sees is his ego self, that small self that small self is alone, cut off from the community of others. But what Dante doesn't know yet, is that he is actually part of a universal, not to say heavenly, community. Virgil is about to fill him in. Because after all, Dante is Aeneas and Paul, and so are we all. Each of us has a script prepared on the mythic level where we take on the role of the hero descending to the underworld, whether the hero is Aeneas or Paul or Dante himself. They're all types of the same archetypal hero, which we are all invited to join ourselves to as soon as we come to ourselves in our own dark wood. And this can happen to us, not just in the middle of our life, but in the middle of anything we're doing. We can become Aeneas, Paul, Dante 5 times an hour. See, the conquering hero comes from Handel's Judas Maccabeus, sung by the Cambridge Voices. And when I tell Ian De Mazzini that we played his piece, he'll be very, very happy. Well, Dante's not yet a conquering hero, nor are we, I assume, but it's coming. It's on its way as soon as we start being called. And what leads us on? What does Virgil tell Dante to lead him on? It's not some abstraction like saving the world or even saving his soul, but a concrete image, a story even. Abstractions can't really move us. Only images and concrete details can. And here's the story Virgil tells Dante. It's a story that runs a little backwards. First one event and then the event that led up to that event and then the event that led up to that event. So, Virgil tells Dante that he was just in his usual place in the afterworld, in limbo, the place of those who are not damned but who cannot attain to heaven. We'll get into this in a few more weeks. Just hanging around with the other Greek and Roman poets when a beautiful lady, beautiful and blessed, Beata e Bella, came to him, so beautiful in fact, that all Virgil can do is humble himself and ask her to command him. And here's a little lesson for us. Beauty, especially when it's blessed, asks us to serve it, not possess it or use it, but to let it inspire us to act courteously and to do fine things. The lady is Beatrice, Dante's ideal beloved, the lady behind all his earlier love poetry, now dead and residing in heaven. She's become aware that l'amico mio, her friend, meaning Dante, has fallen into bad ways and has lost his path in the dark wood and been frightened by the beasts on the slope of the mountain and turned back in despair. In other words, she knows what happened just an hour or so ago. "Would you be so kind," she asks, "as to go over to that dark wood and," as she puts it, "with your polished words and whatever else is needed for his safety, go to his aid, that I may be consoled." Now, we crass modern human beings might just say, "Yeah, of course, no problem. I'm on my way this moment." But Virgil is cortese, courteous. Beatrice has inspired him to be courteous as a response to her beauty. And he says the same thing in much more elegant language. "So pleased am I at your command that my consent, were it already given, would be given late. You have but to make your desire known." And yet for all that, Virgil does not rush off immediately. He asks a question. The Divine Comedy is full of questions. Everybody wants to know things. That's our great human attribute. We'll find Dante asking questions all along the way, trying to understand what's going on around him, because it's only by knowing what's going on that we can orientate ourselves and see the right choices to make. What Virgil asks Beatrice seems a little off the point, but it arises out of his amazement at this unexpected situation. It also helps us, the reader, get a better understanding of the dynamics of the world we're going to be reading about. There's Virgil in limbo, there's Beatrice obviously coming from heaven. "Aren't you afraid to come down here," Virgil asks, "and to leave the heavenly bliss you're enjoying? Don't you think it's a little dangerous around here, not to say unpleasant for your sort?" Beatrice courteously answers him, though, as she says, "brevemente," briefly, sort of reminding him that these questions are all very fine, but doesn't he have an important mission to be getting on with? "Well, no," she says, there's nothing for me to fear in coming down to the underworld. We fear only those things that can do us harm, and as a blessed heavenly soul, I cannot be harmed by anything down here. Besides, she is down here under divine protection. She too is on a mission and is sent by none other than the Virgin Mary, who, presumably looking down on earth from heaven, noticed the woeful state Dante had fallen into, took pity on him, and summoned Lucia, St. Lucy, the patron saint of light, who enlightens us in our dark wood experience. "Look after Dante," she tells Lucy. Now, enlightenment, even divine enlightenment, does not come to us directly, but through the appropriate channels. And the appropriate channel for enlightening Dante is Beatrice, the one whom Dante amò tanto, whom he loved so much. So Beatrice sets off to contact Virgil as the next appropriate channel for enlightening grace to come to Dante. But wait, why does she have to go through Virgil? Why can't Beatrice herself come to Dante in the dark wood? Well, I think one explanation is that Dante is so far gone in his darkness and despair that he simply is in no shape to respond to Beatrice. Her presence would probably drive him crazy, or might even be too bright for him to comprehend what was going on. Now, he needs someone like Virgil, who in the poem is not only Virgil, but also stands for the voice of poetry and human reason. These are the things that Dante, in his present state, can still respond to. And so we get this dance, this chain, from Mary to Lucy to Beatrice to Virgil to Dante. Couldn't they find a more direct way to get Dante to change? Some way of getting the message to him that was more, well, effective? Yeah, I'm sure the heavenly powers could have found a more efficient way, but it seems that heaven is not too concerned, as we are, with efficiency. It prefers prodigality, spending itself so that it can include as many as possible. Heaven's a big dance, or what is called lila in Sanskrit, the Hindu perception that the central energy behind the whole world is playfulness. And so, indirectly through this multi-layered story of Virgil's, we are shown another lesson in the poem, through this image of what it's like to live a joyful, fulfilled life, taking part in the playful heavenly dance. That was the Hilliard Ensemble with the double motet of O Maria, Maris Stella, Veritatem. A celebration of the heavenly dance initiated by Mary, the motet form enacting the way each part dances around the others. So, the three saintly women in heaven initiate the dance that will manifest itself as Dante's journey through hell, purgatory, and heaven itself. And in fact invites us in to join the dance, as each of Dante's experiences have the ability to work on us and bring us to greater self-awareness. And after relating to Dante this story about Mary taking pity on Dante, asking Santa Lucia to help, who then asked Beatrice to take matters in hand, who then came to Virgil to ask him to lead Dante on a redeeming journey. After relating all this, Virgil now turns to Dante and he says, "Okay, now how about it, man?" That's the way we would say it in Philadelphia. But the way Dante puts it is like this. "And so I come to you just as Beatrice wished. I saved you from the beast denying you the short way to the mountain of delight. What then? Why do you delay? Why do you let such cowardice rule your heart? Why are you not more spirited and sure when three such blessed ladies care for you in heaven's court, and my words promise so much good? And like little flowers opening up once the morning sunlight hits them, so Dante's failing strength comes back to life, and he confirms his resolution to go on this journey. My will is the same as your will, he tells Virgil. Let's hit the road. Tu duca, tu signore, e tu maestro. You leader, you lord, and you master. And then he enters per lo cammino alto e silvestro, on the deep and savage way. Canto 2 thus ends in the same place as Canto 1 had ended, with Dante about to set foot on the journey. But at the end of Canto 1, he was going out of fear for what lay behind him, those ferocious beasts. Whereas now, he's going out of desire for what lies ahead, empowered by the understanding that he is not io sol uno, one person alone, but rather part of a much larger scheme of things. And as long as he can remember this, he is safe and not lost. Okay, was that good marching music to set off on a journey into hell? Yes, well, it was a short piece called The Potala from an album by Chris Burrows called Tibetan Journey, with Chris playing, I think, all the percussion instruments. Well, and so we leave the inferno for this week. Stay tuned for next time, when Dante and Virgil come to the gates of hell and read the famous notice there, Lasciate ogni speranza voi che entrate, abandon all hope ye who enter here. And they hear the screams of all the damned souls down in the pit of hell. They enter and encounter the pusillanimi, those who've never done anything with their lives or dared to make any choices between right and wrong, good or evil. And we'll watch as Dante and Virgil are ferried by Charon across the first river they encounter, which buffets them with such strong winds and flaming light that Dante passes out. That's what's in store for next time. But wait, we're not finished with this evening's Evening Under Lamplight. I want to invite us to attend to one of Leonard Cohen's oddest songs, Paper Thin Hotel. Leonard has placed himself in many strange situations, but perhaps this is the strangest, or even some might think the most perverse. Here he is, in some cheap hotel with paper-thin walls, sitting alone in a room next to the room where someone he loves is making love with someone else. He listens intently to the sounds of their lovemaking, including running the bathwater afterwards, and then has an epiphany. I heard that love was out of my control, he learns. Maybe the most arresting thing about this song is the detail. He doesn't just say he heard them in the next room, but he heard the struggle, mouth to mouth and limb to limb, partly heard and partly reconstructed in his fevered, obsessed imagination. And then the grunt of unity when he came in. You can scarcely get a more concrete detail about sex, and yet entirely without obscenity. The obscenity, in fact, is found on his side of the wall as he pictures himself standing there with my ear against the wall, not quite a voyeur, but an auditeur. But even this potentially obscene picture of spying on his lover with someone else next door is transformed. He's not seized by jealousy at all. Much to his surprise, we gather, he'd gone there, we presume, filled with jealousy, torturing himself by wanting even more evidence of her unfaithfulness. But surprise, that's not what happens. He doesn't feel jealousy after all. The heavy burden of jealousy, a heavy burden indeed, is lifted from his soul. I learned that love is out of my control. What did he think? That he could control love? That he could maybe spring upon them in their room and stop their lovemaking and control her love back to him? Or maybe he thought he could listen in and then destroy the love he felt for her? In any case, he's trying to control the way he or she feels, and he learns that doesn't happen. Why not? There's no answer given to us. That may be what makes this song so endlessly engaging. But I can hazard a guess. As he listened to what was going on in the next room, has he been moved by her obvious great pleasure? Has his jealous, possessive love, all jealousy involves possessiveness, has this jealousy been transformed into a true love that seeks what is best for the other person? Do things work like that? The intensity of his longing took him deep into the reality of the situation. He says, I never heard the world so clear before. He hears through his jealousy to her true self, which is full of satisfied joy, as perhaps she'd never been when she was with him. Jealous people don't make good lovers. They're too concerned with the other person as their possession, not as a person in his or her own right. But then perhaps the oddest part of this odd song, I can't wait to tell you to your face, he says. And I can't wait for you to take my place. What's that? I can't wait to tell you how great it felt for me to listen to you making love to someone else. And I can't wait until you can listen in on me making love to someone else too. Kinky? No, surely not. It's this delight in seeing the other person so clearly. I can't wait to tell you how free from jealousy my love is for you. And I love you so much now that I want you too to listen to my joy, so maybe you can experience this clear vision and great love too. Is he then idolizing her or idealizing her when he gives her these two mythic labels? You are the naked angel in my heart. You are the woman with her legs apart. Again, we ask if this is obscene. To certain minds, it certainly is. But in the context of this song, she, in the act of making love, the woman with her legs apart, becomes the naked angel of his heart, the angel bringing this transforming epiphany to his heart. And maybe our clue lies in the final stanza. It's written on the walls of this hotel, you go to heaven once you've been to hell. Written on the walls, that is, communicated through the words and sounds that come to him through the wall, I suppose. In other words, he could never have come to a true love for her own sake, until he had suffered the torments of jealousy. The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom, as William Blake said, and as Leonard Cohen says here, the heavy burden of jealousy can lead to a heavenly love. Maybe this explanation works. I offer it for you to try it on and see if it fits for you. But in any case, this is also the lesson we see Dante learning, right? He can get to heaven and to Beatrice only once he's been through hell. Once he accepts that, he's on his way with the courage to face whatever he encounters on that deep and savage journey. We could listen to Leonard Cohen's version of the song from Death of a Ladies' Man, that album produced, overproduced by Phil Spector. But let's try a different version. There have been many covers, most of which seem to milk the lyrics too much, getting a little too soppy. I think they work better in a more deadpan way, and I found this in the version by the Finnish singer Hasse Vestergaard, who seems to capture the feel of Leonard as well as of the song. It feels like the way the song would have sounded before Phil Spector got his hands on it. Here it is.
fact, a burden lifted from my soul. I heard that love was out of my control. A heavy burden lifted from my soul. I learned that love was out of
Okay, well, that was Hasse Vestergaard doing Leonard Cohen's song Paper Thin Hotel, and Andrew Abey found a connection here.
I was just thinking about the great film High Fidelity, and there's a wonderful line in it where the main character, Rob, is lying in bed thinking about his ex-girlfriend who's up a few floors with a new boyfriend, and he says, "No woman in the history of the world is having better sex than the sex you are having with Ian. In my head."
Yeah, you see, that was wonderful because he's still in his head. He's still got that heavy burden of jealousy. And the character in this song, because he listened so intently, has moved from his head to the real world and has been freed from that burden. So let's all be voyeurs, and that we'll be all healed by paying attention to what our obsessions are pushing us towards. And that's it. That's our show this evening, Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 with Robert Louis Abrahamson. Come back in a fortnight for further adventures with Dante down that deep and savage path to hell and more besides. And for me and my guest in the studio, Andrew A.B., here's a warm good night.